Support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients a solution for failed root canal treated teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Orlando, New Jersey, New York and Miami, and Dallas and Denver as well, and Phoenix and Portland, Seattle. Teams in today's NBA are a lot, and yet one thing is clear. That, of course, is that the 28 teams that aren't the Lakers will be eating LA's dust at the end of the season that has just begun. Or so it has been safe to assume for some time now. But there is some speculation that another California team, the Sacramento Kings, may at last be ready to topple the Lakers next spring. Joining me now is the co-president of the Kings, Gavin Malouf. Mr. Malouf, welcome to Only a Game.
Bill, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Since you and your brother Joe took over the Kings in 1998, the team has made the transition from league doormat to now favorite to win it all. How'd you guys do it in such a short time?
Well, I guess it's just maybe believing in our abilities to know what the right things were to do. I walked into the Arco Arena and on our first visit when we first bought 10% of the club, and really, I saw about 100 things that needed to be changed. Just a smile from the ushers, from the ticket takers. The entire arena needed an attitude change. We put all the employees were in jeans and T-shirts, and we put them all in uniforms, made them feel good about themselves. We lightened the concession stands up. They had a dull orange tint in the lighting, and that was because of they were trying to save money. So we went to a fluorescent white bright light that made the concession stands look more appetizing. We painted the arena. Just a whole attitude change, and the public started noticing it, and they started coming back.
How much does an owner have to do with the kind of day-to-day improvement and performance of a basketball team?
Well, I think the owner sets the tone. And I don't think that it's one person that causes a franchise to be a success or a failure. I believe it's everybody involved in the organization. And we tell our people, from the ticket takers to the ushers to the dance team to the general manager, the coach, the players, everybody has a role to play. And that role is to cater to people, to cater to the customer, to make the fans experience the best possible in the league. And that's what we've done. And we feel everybody in our organization is important.
Also improving over the past 3 years is the competition between the Kings and three-time champs Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers barely beat the Kings in last year's Western Conference Finals. Maybe that's the best rivalry not only in the NBA but in pro sports.
Well, we think it is. It's an unbelievable rivalry. There's there's bad blood there, and it's not manufactured. It's inherent in both of the teams because, and I happen to like a lot of the Laker players personally. They've been in our casino, the Palms in Las Vegas, and I happen to like them. But once you get on court, they want to win, we want to win, and we're bitter enemies.
I have to ask: does a man running a casino especially like patrons who spend and lose a lot of money in that casino? Is that what we're saying about the Lakers?
Well, I don't know if they lost any money, but they stayed there actually for a preseason game. The Suns and the Lakers stayed with us, and we took very good care of them. We saw Kobe, and we promised we wouldn't poison him, so we gave him good food. But they're competitive. The pro athletes, they want to win. We want to win, and it just goes from there. But it's really a heated rivalry.
Maybe too heated. There was a nasty fight between the Kings' Doug Christie and the Lakers' Rick Fox in the final preseason game. I wonder if that's a sign the rivalry is getting a little too heated.
It's like I say, they're competitive, and they're out there battling, and things happen on the court. Of course, we don't condone fighting, but with our guy, Doug Christie, he had to defend himself, so things got a little out of hand, and we just hope that doesn't happen again.
This rivalry business, of course, is fascinating to fans always. We have, of course, the Yankees-Red Sox rivalry here in Boston, although some wag pointed out not long ago that there is no rivalry between a hammer and a nail, and so maybe the Yankees and Red Sox aren't really a rivalry. Are the Lakers the hammer, and until you win, will Sacramento be the nail?
We don't believe that. We believe that that we were actually the better team last year, and I'm sure if you saw the series and you saw what happened in the series, I mean, we felt we should have won. Now, I'm not crying sour grapes. I give them credit. They won the championship. You know, you got to give them credit. They won. However, they didn't sweep us. We won three games. They won four. But they can be beat, and we feel that that we can beat them anytime, anywhere. But, of course, we have to prove it on the court.
Are there other teams in the Western Conference that you guys look at and say, boy, that team's really improved, or are you focused pretty much entirely on the Lakers?
No, you have to be concerned with the, there's a lot of great teams in the West. Look at Dallas. I mean, Mark Cuban's done an excellent job of putting that group together, and Portland's going to be tough again. They're always tough. They have so much talent. San Antonio, they're going to be better. A lot of the teams in the West got better, so it's kind of like keeping up with the Joneses. You know, we're trying to keep up with everybody, but it's tough in the West.
The West has been the iron in the NBA lately, but what about the East? Are there teams in the East that you say, boy, I wouldn't mind facing them in the finals?
Well, they have, you know, the New Jersey's going to be better. I think they've bolstered their club. Charlotte should be someone to contend with, and There's a handful of teams in the East as well, but I just really feel that the power resides in the West.
Gavin Maloof is co-owner of the Sacramento Kings. Mr. Maloof, thank you again for joining us, and good luck. I hope you have a great season.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Two years ago, American Greco-Roman wrestler Rulon Gardner defeated Russian Alexander Karelin to earn gold at Sydney and provide one of the biggest upsets in Olympic history. Karelin, widely considered to be the best ever at his sport, had not lost a single match in 13 years and hadn't conceded a single point in the decade leading up to his defeat at the huge hands of the Wyoming farmer. Unfortunately, Gardner also made news last February after he became stranded while snowmobiling on a mountain near his home in Afton, Wyoming, and nearly froze to death. Gardner spent the night alone in temperatures that dipped to 25 degrees below zero. After his rescue, he lost the middle toe of his right foot to frostbite. Now Gardner has returned to the mat and hopes to once again compete at the highest level. Greg Eklund reports.
The wrestling room at the U.S. Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs is a long way from Wyoming's Wagner Mountain. Now, after an eight-month recovery, Gardner is there with hopes of making it back to the national team. One wouldn't expect the hulking 286-pounder to be a bit scared before his return to the mat, but he was.
I was kind of apprehensive because the tissue on my feet was so vulnerable to injury, to all types of accidents that could happen. And like for the first while, for the first few weeks of practice, I had individuals stepping on my feet, and when they would step, they'd actually tear that tissue off. And so having and knowing that that was possible was really made me kind of scared.
Gardner didn't ask for all the fame that resulted from winning gold in Sydney, but he's having a good time with it. Between workouts, Gardner attends an outside photo shoot on the training center campus for a magazine feature.
All right, Rulon, turn square, a little bit more square to me so I can see both shoulders. Cool. I don't know if they'll fit in the frame, really.
Gardner, who not too long ago was anonymous, knows that few Olympic wrestlers enjoy fame. But his own place in sports history commands attention at places like Mr. Big's Diner in Colorado Springs.
Must be Rulon.
That's me.
How you doing?
Oh, you are the man.
But despite Gardner's achievements and the long tradition of Greco-Roman wrestling, there are concerns over the future of the sport. Gardner is rallying support for the inclusion of wrestling, even as the International Olympic Committee is considering the elimination of either freestyle or Greco-Roman from the Summer Olympics. The IOC is expected to decide which sports to abandon at its meeting in Mexico City at the end of this month.
Nobody is going to stand up and fight for the wrestling world because, people support it, people like it, people enjoy it, but nobody hears from them. And the IOC needs to know that this is not right.
Gardner is not one to hold anything back, as evidenced by his vocal support for wrestling, his efforts to return to world-class competition, and by his wish to return to the summit of Wagner Mountain, where he almost lost his life last February.
All of us have a circle in our lives. We want to be complete. We want to have things that are unfinished finish. And that night, I didn't make it out of there. That night, I left my snowmobile, and I thought I was dead. And I need to be able to go back in and close things up.
But what is there to complete in Rulon Gardner's wrestling career? How could he possibly top his win over Alexander Karelin 2 years ago?
You know, after I went to Sydney and won the gold medal, I came back and won the world championships last year. So I'm a world and Olympic champion. People said after Sydney, why are you even thinking about wrestling again? If you lose, you won't, you know, you'll be tarnished. You'll have lost a match. And I said, you know what? It's not about the gold medals. It's about knowing in my heart that I did the best that I could for me and for what I desire.
The coming weeks will determine whether Gardner's feet are strong enough to hold up against top-notch competition or whether he'll get a chance to defend his gold medal 2 years from now in Athens. Gardner has the following warning for his opponents.
I'm going to be back and I'm going to be in their face and I'm going to be, you know, kind of their worst nightmare. Even though I'm not 100%, I want to let them know that even though I was out for 8 months because of my feet, doesn't matter. You know, I'm back and I'm a bad dude and I want to, you know, do everything I can.
Gardner will wrestle next weekend at the Kurt Angle Classic in New Orleans. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Colorado Springs. It's 18 minutes past the hour. Mrs. Anne Leatherdale, who runs the Swan Pub in Brewood, Staffordshire, claims that she can tell which team will win a soccer match by looking into the froth of a glass of beer. That's just ridiculous.
Well, you buy a pint of best bitter, mate, and I'll just show you.
Mrs. Leatherdale says she has foreseen that England will thrash Turkey, a Euro 2004 group rival, and she says that Liverpool will finish first in the Premier League this season.
They will, you know.
And she claims to have won £500 with their beer-based bets. Could I just look in that glass for a bit there?
Oh, just shove off, love. Come on, this is my pub, my bitter. Come on, my foam, I'll do it myself. Now, you just get on out of here.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. For a complete wrap-up of NBA scores and NHL action, log on to our website, wbur.org, and click on News. We are funded by you, our listeners, and by Toyota, featuring the Toyota Prius, the Sierra Club's award-winning hybrid-powered four-door sedan, featured during WBUR's Prius Pledge Drive, available at a New England Toyota dealer. By Direct Tire and Auto Service, winner of the 2001 Retailer of the Year Award by the Retailers Association of Massachusetts, on the web at directtire.com. And by the Nature Conservancy, working to protect the landscapes, forest, and waterways of Massachusetts for future generations, on the web at nature.org. Cold outside today, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 30s, tonight's lows near 30, tomorrow's highs in the mid-40s. It is 29 degrees in Boston at 720.
I'm Bill Littlefield. So, you want a lucrative career banishing a tackle maggot or a furball plague bearer? Ahead on Only a Game, one magical possibility. But first, tomorrow, some 30,000 runners, serious and otherwise, will compete in the New York Marathon. Among those most likely to regard the race as a comparatively tame challenge is Chris Moon. In 1995, while in Mozambique removing landmines and teaching others to do so, Chris Moon lost the lower part of his right leg as well as much of his right arm to a mine explosion. Since about a year after the accident, he's been running marathons and taking on various other challenges. Chris Moon joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Chris, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
What made you decide that running marathons would be a good idea after the accident that destroyed a leg and an arm?
One of the reasons I survived was partly due to some of the military training I'd had, and also due to the fact that I was fit. I was a very passionate runner before I was injured, and I desperately wanted to get my life back and to run again. Mm-hmm. And particularly when I was told that it would be very, very difficult, I set my heart on it and put a lot of effort into it. And I had no idea it would be as hard as it was to learn again, but it was possible to do it. And I think the big education is that in life, sometimes we think it's all tough. The important thing is never give up, never give up.
In a way, the New York Marathon must seem routine because I understand that you're a veteran of an event that requires running through the Sahara Desert for 6 days and more. Are all other events easy after something like that?
Good question. No. I suppose you're always confronting your own fear of failure if you're going to try and do your best. And as I've really gone on with years from being blown up, I found that there are a whole different range of technical problems. For example, when my stump stopped contracting at about the 4 or 5 year point, I kept my legs for longer, and I found I was wearing them out much quicker because of the distance I was doing. So as I wore, for example, my heel out, it put my back out because my foot was dropping half an inch. Little things like that. So there are always challenges, and the marathon, 26.2 miles, is a daunting distance for anyone. And I take my hat off to anyone who's running and gets around, and I've seen some incredible people on marathons.
But competing in that desert event, it suggests to me that you're inclined to look for the greatest possible challenge at all times. What's on your schedule after the New York Marathon?
I'd like to do something in the UK. I'd like to do some more ultra distance there. Mm-hmm. But a very important driving force for me is that I've got commitments to a lot of charities through these events to raise money and to raise their profile. So a lot of it is not about me, to be honest. It's about issues much more important than me.
I understand that you are competing tomorrow under the auspices of an organization called Concern Worldwide USA. Who benefits from the money that you'll be raising through that organization?
Well, I'm running for Concern tomorrow for a program helping children in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. The genocide was 10 years ago. From my experiences working in Africa, I think education is so important. And in any conflict, in any desperate situation, it's very easy to forget children. And the future of any nation is through children. And, of course, frequently children have no voice. I think the betrayal of innocence is one of the worst things. The work that Concern does, helping people who are the most vulnerable, I think is hugely worthwhile. I've seen their work for 10 years, and there's certainly a good enough reason for me to put one foot in front of the other and to put my hand in my pocket.
You've been competing in marathons and running as well in other events for some time now. When you show up at the start of one of these events, what's it like? Do people look at you and do double takes? Is there still a certain amount of astonishment at what you can do?
Well, I've had a few years to get used to it now, but it still happens when you do a race where people don't necessarily know you. You all chat, you're in there waiting, and then somebody looks down and sees that I'm slightly inadequate in the limb department in two areas, and there is an element of shock. It's something I've got used to, but, you know, we're all the same inside, and I think the important thing is to get out there and do the best you can. That's what life's all about. It is about going the distance and doing a personal best.
I was amazed to learn at a track meet a while back that the most accomplished amputee sprinters run times that are only a hundredth or two hundredths of a second slower than the most accomplished non-amputee sprinters. Is there a comparable situation for amputee marathoners?
Certainly, sadly, not in my case. I'm a long way behind the front guys. At the moment, it is slightly harder to do longer distances technically because one of the problems is that when you go beyond a certain distance, when you're going beyond 3 miles, most of the suspension methods, the methods for holding the leg on, start to slip with sweat, and that's one of the biggest problems that I have, suspension. And the big problem is that on a marathon, what happens is the stump begins to expand. So you've got to stop and take socks off to allow the stump to actually expand in the socket. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of technical problems that do slow you slightly.
This sounds like it would be extremely painful.
No, I thought you were going to say it sounds like pathetic excuses for being the fat, wheezy boy at the back. No, I will be. I mean, you know, I won't be the fastest, that's true. I'm just going to get round and do the best I can.
What time will you have to run tomorrow to achieve a personal best?
Around about 4 hours, if I could do that, that would be a personal best. Around about 4.5 is what I'm looking for. And not to be the fattest, wheeziest bloke at the back.
Chris Moon will be competing in the New York Marathon tomorrow. Chris, good luck, and thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
Everyone knows that successful pro athletes can earn big salaries, but who knew that fantasy gamers can earn major money at tournaments like next weekend's Magic the Gathering Pro Tour in Houston, Texas? Only a game's Karen Given knows, because she was on hand for a recent stop of the Magic Pro Tour at the Bayside Expo Center in Boston.
Magic is a card game, a trading card game to be more precise. Players buy packs of randomly selected cards. They then mix, match, and trade cards to create decks to play against each other. The company which publishes the cards, Wizards of the Coast, releases new versions of the game every few months, starting the entire process over. Even after sponsoring $3 million in cash prizes at tournaments like this every year, tournament director Jeff Donay admits the game is a bit of a cash cow for the company.
Every year sells, you know, $100 million worth of cards, and there's 250,000-300,000 regular players who play in tournaments, plus, you know, another few million players who just play casually.
A few lucky Magic players, some as young as Cole Swanick, the 12-year-old champion of New Zealand, can make a career out of the game. Magic's top player, referred to by some as the Tiger Woods of Magic, is German Kai Boudet, who earned over $100,000 on the tour last year and more than $250,000 during his career. Most Magic players are high school or college students, but Gary Wise, a friendly man with a slightly receding hairline, is a little older than the average player. But that's because, Wise says, there's never been a reason for him to quit.
Magic's my job. A year ago, I moved to England to live in a palace with a teammate who happened to live in one. So I live in a palace and I travel the world and I play games.
In addition to winning more than $80,000 on the Pro Tour, Wise earns a living writing about the game for Sideboard.com, the official online magazine of the Pro Tour. Wise likens the game to chess, where players are looking multiple moves ahead and figuring out mathematical probabilities along the way. But Magic, Wise says, has a lot more intrigue.
The idea of the game is to reduce your opponent's life from 20 to 0. You're trying to kill your opponent, and you're doing that by attacking with creatures. You know, those are pretty aggressive concepts. It seems like a goofy little card game, but once you get to the table, you know, the trash talk will fly just as much as on a basketball court or whatever. And there are a lot of mental games that go on, too. So you're constantly on your guard, and you're constantly on the offense at the same time.
While players wait for the tournament to begin, some crouch over cards, fiercely debating strategies and rule interpretations, while others mingle, greeting each other like they're at a reunion. Some teams wear color-coordinated outfits, and many players sport the unhealthy glow of one too many Saturdays indoors.
You have 1 hour for your deck construction. You may begin.
The tournament begins with deck construction. Each three-player team is given two large packs of randomly selected cards. While these players might have hundreds or even thousands of cards at home, they have only these few hundred to choose from for this tournament. Jeff Donay says this is where teamwork is most important.
You might have a team with three brilliant people on it, but if they can't get along and work as a team, then they're just going to lose. When egos are involved, things can just go wrong. If people argue over which cards they want in their deck, if everyone wants the most powerful cards in their deck and they can't share them like a good team, then they won't be as successful as teams that can work well together.
One 121 three-player teams from 20 countries spend the next hour building their decks. They'll play two matches with these decks, and then they build again. In all, the players will spend the next 12 hours focused on this game. And then the lucky ones will come back for another 10 or 12-hour day tomorrow. Donay says the schedule isn't made by accident.
Yeah, it's taxing, but We figure that if they're going to earn $200,000, we're going to make them work for it.
And the players certainly understand the work involved. Eugene Harvey, the current U.S. champion and a student at Carnegie Mellon University, says he and his teammates treat magic as their part-time jobs, a part-time job that's earned Eugene more than $50,000 in the past year.
There's a lot more than just practicing. There's theorizing, like talking with them. There's information all over the internet that you have to keep up with. And there's also a team aspect, like knowing how to play with a team. It's pretty complicated.
After placing their priceless cards in color-coordinated plastic protective sleeves, the players begin the endless shuffling and reshuffling of their decks. This goes on and on and on. Player Andy Stokinger explains.
It's like you're required to randomize your deck sufficiently. So what they deem sufficient is three riffle shuffles. What is actually randomizing your deck by Vegas standards is seven.
And they're doing like 20.
Hey, we're just bored.
Stokinger shuffles his cards under the bright spotlight of the feature area. Here, the more interesting matches are played while spectators watch from a metal catwalk, and internet reporters furiously type play-by-play into their computers. Play-by-play that will eventually sound something like this written report taken from sideboard.com.
The big boys came out to play in the Williams-Stokinger match. Williams seemed to have the upper hand thanks to Kamal Pitfighter. It was attacking alongside Ember Beast and Soul Scourge. But then Stokinger swept the board with Kirtar's Wrath. He almost ran out of time, but he did eventually draw the flyers he needed to win the game.
Players have 2 hours to complete the three games that make a match. If they run out of time, the team that's ahead is given the win. As time grows short during the first match of the tournament, Stokinger's team, Evil Incorporated, is tied with its opponent. As neither team wants the match to end in a draw, tensions grow.
This is taking a long time.
Come on.
Okay. Are those your blocks?
Those are my blocks.
Okay, that's fine.
A crowd gathers to watch as the match comes to an end with Evil Incorporated eking out the win. Jeff Donay says the press of bodies in the gallery is nothing compared to what will happen in the final round.
During the finals, when people are playing for the big money, they definitely cheer. People get pretty involved. You know, when they see their friend winning $35,000 first prize, they get pretty excited for them, especially if they know they'll spread the money around.
And apparently, one thing Magic players know how to do is share their spoils with their friends and opponents, at least until the next tournament rolls around. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Boston.
That is time for Boston.
Time, guys. Act player for the return.
You're listening to Only a Game. For various reasons, paramount among them the fact that almost nobody goes to see the Montreal Expos play, the Spos will soon be playing elsewhere. As Only a Game reported last week, a group of businessmen in Washington, D.C., and another group in Northern Virginia both hope to lure the team south, but nobody in the area has built a stadium yet. Last week also saw the surfacing and the sinking of the delightful rumor that the Expos would play next year's home games in Boston's Fenway Park. So, okay, the Expos are destined to move, but where will they settle? We take you now to the offices of Major League Baseball, the inner sanctum where the tough decisions are made.
Ladies and gentlemen, your Anaheim Expos.
I love it.
I don't think so.
Oh, what do you mean? It's can't miss. Angels fans are all excited about their champions. They'll support two teams easy. We'll give them some different color Thunder Sticks, a raccoon instead of a monkey.
No. California's already got five teams.
Oh, sure, but when somebody else wins the World Series next fall, we move the Expos there.
Ladies and gentlemen, your Atlanta Expos, your New York Expos, your Boston Expos.
Right.
Or wherever.
You can't move the team every year. That's ridiculous. Pick one place.
All right. Well, how about...
Ladies and gentlemen, your Milwaukee Expos.
What do you think, Bud?
I don't think that's funny.
Well, he's got a point, Bud. Milwaukee could use a major league team.
Not funny!
Well, medium funny, but all right. Suppose...
4 days, 11 pizzas, and 74 dozen donuts later.
So, we're all agreed, right? We're together on this?
I suppose so.
Bud?
I don't like it!
Then it's probably the right move. Yeah, play it one more time.
Ladies and gentlemen, your Tajikistan Expos.
Yeah, it's got a nice international ring.
I don't like it. Sounds weird.
Not the easiest road trip either, I guess. Okay, then, how about this?
Madame's et Monsieur's Voter Expos du Montréal.
I don't speak Spanish. What did he say?
Never mind, Bud. The Montreal Expos will presumably open the 2003 season somewhere. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Persian Gallery on Boylston Street in Boston, committed to excellence in bringing decorative new and antique rugs to furnish homes in New England. PersianGalleryInc.com. And by the Music Emporium Music Enthusiast, celebrating the craft of guitar building for more than 200 instruments available in their Lexington showroom. TheMusicEmporium.com. Good morning, I'm Dolores Handy. In sports headlines, the Celtics, licking their wounds from the worst beating in franchise history, travel to New York tonight to face the Knicks. The Washington Wizards trounced Boston 114-69 Thursday night in Washington. It is the worst loss in Celtics' 56-year history. Boston is 0-2, still looking for that first win of the season. The Bruins will be hoping to start a new unbeaten streak tonight against the New York Rangers at the Fleet Center. Boston's 8-game unbeaten streak went by the boards in a 4-1 loss to Anaheim on Thursday. The Bruins are having fan problems, though. The crowd of 9,000 was the smallest since the team began playing in the Fleet Center. And Boston College plays unbeaten number 4-ranked Notre Dame this afternoon. This spring, join Jackie Leiden on the next Citizens of the World tour to Vietnam. To learn more about this trip, call 800-909-9287. Sunny skies today, but quite cold. Highs in the upper 30s. Tonight's lows near 30. Tomorrow, mostly sunny. Highs in the 40s. Monday's highs in the upper 30s. Tuesday, election day, a chance of rain or snow. Highs in the 40s.
Harpist Deborah Henson-Conan speaking on The Connection about her style of playing.
I started improvising on these classical tunes, and then I started realizing that I could play jazz tunes. And that evolved to the point that I realized I was having much more fun playing jazz tunes than playing in symphony orchestras.
See Deborah Henson-Conant live in a performance to benefit WBUR on Friday, November 22nd at the Regent Theater in Arlington. For tickets, call 781-646-4849 or log on to WBUR.org.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, John Feinstein on his most recent book, The Punch. But first, analysis of the week's sports news, courtesy of Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The words Utah Jazz and Karl Malone seem almost synonymous, and yet the mailman hinted this week that he wishes to change zip codes. What's up?
Well, he apparently would like perhaps to end his career as King of Mardi Gras. he's intrigued, of course, by the possibility of ending his career in New Orleans. He grew up in Summerfield, which is really sort of Baja, Arkansas, when you come right down to it. But New Orleans, the New Orleans team is probably as close as he's going to be able to get to finishing his career at home. I think it would be an intriguing thing if, along with letting Malone finish his career in New Orleans, the teams traded nicknames so that we would once again have the New Orleans Jazz and then we would have the Utah Grizzlies.
Seems about right. The Lakers, meanwhile, are off to a terrible start. Three games into their season, Shaq is on the bench. Now reports have it that the big Aristotle has directed his considerable wrath toward Hall of Famer Bill Walton. What's up with that?
Well, obviously, he looked at him and saw a sophist, and there was could have been a possible punch-up around the academy.
Mm-hmm.
It is impossible to estimate how little the Los Angeles Lakers' start matters. Nothing in the NBA, let alone anything with the Los Angeles Lakers, matters until the big Aristotle puts his shoe back on his sore foot and goes out there. Apparently, Bill Walton has been concerned that Shaq's weight might be causing problems with his feet. Shaq has been upset about that. Apparently, Shaq used a word not often heard around Vacation Bible School in Walton's direction the other night. This is all toy boats and rubber ducks in the bathtub. As I said, none of this will matter in the spring.
NBA Commissioner David Stern announced this week that when the league goes to 30 teams, perhaps for the 2004-2005 season, he wants to go to six divisions and, quote, start some real trouble. The commish really lives on the edge, doesn't he?
If he expands to 30 teams, he's got real trouble no matter what he does to the division. That's too damn many!
The National Football League has formed a diversity committee, Charlie, presumably to address the issue of the dearth of black coaches and management officials in the league. So racial parity can't be far behind, I gather?
I'm not exactly sure what the committee is going to do except sit around and eat donuts and make a lot of nice noises. I don't know what committees do. They're like task forces. Any task force that's not made up of an aircraft carrier and a bunch of battleships gets very little done, and should nothing made up of human beings with memo pads should ever be referred to as a task force, because whatever force it has, it's never directed towards accomplishing the task. You know, this is a real mess, and it's a mess of the NFL's own making, and there's no easy way out of this. The problem is there's got to be a solution. Otherwise, this lawsuit is going to progress, and the NFL is going to have this issue attached to its leg like a boxer dog for the rest of the decade at least. I'm not exactly sure what they're going to do. This diversity committee, whatever its charge, is not going to make this issue go away. It's not going to disappear. I think the one thing that could happen, and I am not standing on one leg waiting for it, is players could take an action. That players could get together and say, unless there is progress made on this issue, you are going to see a wildcat job action some Sunday. But since they're all, you know, more interested in endorsement dollars in their stock portfolios than ever standing up for anything, I don't expect this.
It seems to me that the National Football League season has been characterized by more fines and suspensions for illegal hits than usual, at least in the early going. I don't know if I'm right about that in terms of the math. What do you think?
Well, they're being very, very, very strict about the rule on helmet-to-helmet hits, and good for them, by the way. Brian Dawkins was fined $50,000 this week for a helmet-to-helmet hit on a wide receiver from the Giants named Ike Hilliard, who's out for the year, because Dawkins speared Hilliard in the chest with a helmet and separated his shoulder. You had the hit that Darren Woodson from Dallas put on Seattle, Darryl Jackson, which really looked like Jackson was dead. There is a way to tackle without using your helmet. I know it gets you a big hit and a big burst of publicity on SportsCenter, but it really is a dangerous thing. And while I like the NFL, I don't think anybody should have to die for it.
The Minnesota Wild are making folks in the upper Midwest forget about the North Stars of old. How do you explain the NHL expansion team's success in the early going in the hockey season?
Former communists.
Simple.
I mean, everyone gets a boatload of former communists near the go. The Wild started out very well. They absolutely thrashed the Boston Bruins, who've turned out to be a better team than people thought in the first game of the year. Sergei Zoltok is just a terrific, terrific player. And Jacques Lemaire knows how to put winning hockey teams together. He did it in New Jersey, and he's doing it there. And it would be such a sweet moment for the hockey fans of the state of Minnesota, which is one of the two or three places in America that actually cares about hockey on every level, right down to high school, to take the Minnesota Wild into the playoffs and beat the carpet-bagging Dallas Stars.
In another interesting hockey story, Charlie, Cincinnati Cyclones co-owner Phil Esposito wants to hire Team Canada star forward Haley Wickenheiser. This is not the first time that Esposito has tried to break the gender barrier in pro hockey, eh?
No, when he was at the Tampa Bay Lightning of the NHL, he signed Manon Raymond in 1992, and she actually played goalie in the National Hockey League. Of course, Wickenheiser is a positional player. Which never made any sense to me. That makes goalie sound like a place kicker instead of the most important person on the team. I still believe that the position of NHL goalie is going to be the position through which the gender barrier in professional sports is finally broken. It does not require a great deal of size. It requires terrific reflexes and a goodly amount of courage. And I think that more so than a football place kicker or a baseball pitcher, a goalie in the National Hockey League is going to be the position through which the gender barrier is broken in the major sports.
Soccer fans in Argentina have established the Hand of God Church, Charlie. This is a church that honors Diego Maradona. I hate to think what they might partake of at communion.
Well, first of all, they're named after cheating.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this was a very famous example of cheating.
Precisely.
But I think that rookie New England Revolution star Taylor Twellman should go and join this church, because then you would have Maradona and Child.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and works without a net each week here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill. Porque estamos unidos del alma, quién sabe hasta cuándo. Solamente la mano de Dios podrá separar. Cuando tú me trajiste tu amor, yo te estaba esperando.
Nearly 25 years ago, during a fight that had interrupted a basketball game between the Los Angeles Lakers and the Houston Rockets, Lakers forward Kermit Washington punched Rockets forward Rudy Tomjanovich in the face. John Feinstein, the author of several extremely successful sports books, found in the examination of that event and its aftermath the subject for his current book, The Punch. John Feinstein joins me now from his home in Maryland. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Good to talk to you again.
For those who are not familiar with the act at the center of your book, perhaps you could briefly describe it.
Sure. December 9th, 1977, as you said, a routine NBA game in the Los Angeles Forum between the Los Angeles Lakers and the Houston Rockets. And early in the second half, what was really just a scuffle broke out between Kermit Washington of the Lakers and Kevin Kuhnert of the Rockets. And when the whistle blew as the two players squared off, Rudy Tomjanovich was on the far end of the court running a fast break because the Rockets had the ball. And when he saw Kuhnert squared off with Washington, with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar behind Kuhnert and trying to swing Kuhnert away to break up the fight, he ran toward the fight as a peacemaker, hoping to pull Kermit away and thus end the fight. NBA fights happened almost every night in those days, Bill. They were so routine that the league had just passed rules the previous summer ratcheting up the penalties that players faced if they were involved in fights. As Rudy ran toward the fight, Kermit, out of the corner of his eye, saw a red uniform, the Rockets uniform, coming toward him, and instinctively just turned around and delivered this devastating blow. Devastating in the sense that Kermit was one of the first guys in the NBA to seriously do weight training. He was 6'8", 225 pounds of chiseled muscle. And devastating in the sense that Rudy was running full speed when he ran into the punch. And literally, it almost killed him because it landed in such a way that it dislocated his skull to the point where he was leaking spinal fluid from his brain when he got into the hospital that night. And he was very fortunate that the doctor and the trainer on the scene at the Forum immediately recognized that this was a serious injury and called in a specialist to the emergency room who probably saved his life.
The injustice that you return to several times in your book is that both of these men are remembered for the punch rather than for, in the case of Tomjanovich, winning championships as a coach, or in the case of Washington, considerable work on behalf of children in Kenya. To what extent is it the fault of the folks who cover sports and athletes that the punch has lived so large?
There's certainly some culpability there. I think, though, that part of it is, that film, that awful film of the incident. And when you see it, you literally kind of catch your breath. And that's one of the reasons why people keep running that tape, because you can't watch that tape and not be horrified. So I think there is some guilt there. But I also think that as David Stern, who is now the NBA commissioner and then was the league's outside counsel, said to me, that punch, even now today, is the definition of why we have all the rules that we have involving fighting in the NBA, because it is still what you look at when you want to see the worst thing that can possibly happen if you allow men this big and this strong to square off with one another. Even just during the exhibition season, when that fight between the Lakers and Sacramento Kings broke out and you saw Shaquille O'Neal involved in the scuffle, people automatically think if Shaquille ever landed a punch, it could have the same effect as Kermit's punch on Rudy. So I think because it became a defining moment in the NBA, it is still a part of their lives and something, as you said, both of them feel they've never been able to escape from in spite of all the other things they've done with their lives.
You make that point on the cover of the book. The subtitle of The Punch characterizes that night 25 years ago as, quote, the fight that changed basketball forever.
Right.
But how so? Couldn't an enormously strong man landing an especially unfortunate punch do the same sort of damage in a game today? And would he necessarily be banished for life? I mean, is there really a deterrent now?
Well, the fact that it hasn't happened again like this would indicate that perhaps it is. But I think, I will give you an example. In that, the season before this incident occurred, there were 41 fights in the NBA that led to ejections and suspensions. Last year, there were 8. That's certainly a marked improvement. It's not perfect, but it does make you aware of the fact that the players understand now that if they are involved in a fight, if they are the third man in, which in effect is what Rudy was, even though he was trying to be a peacemaker, they face serious consequences from the league. You may remember the 1998 playoff series between the New York Knicks and the Miami Heat, where a fight broke out and Patrick Ewing of the Knicks, among others, basically just wandered onto the court
right
during the fight. And they were all suspended, even though they never threw a punch, because the league feels that based on this incident, you cannot allow fights to escalate when they break out, because when they escalate, that's when potentially the worst damage can be done.
Rudy Tomjanovich is a successful coach now. Have you a sense of what he thinks of the book now that you've written it?
Yes, Rudy and Kermit both called me. I sent them advanced copies in part because I wanted them to fact check for me in case I had anything factually incorrect, but also because it was important to me how they felt about the book since they are the book. And it was fascinating, Bill, because they each said the exact same thing to me in opening the conversation when they called, which was, I never knew all that stuff about him.
Each because, meeting the other, obviously.
Yes, because needless to say, they hadn't researched each other's backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And Kermit had no idea that Rudy had grown up in just as tough and just as difficult a neighborhood and circumstance in Detroit as he had in Washington. And Rudy knew nothing about the fact that nobody recruited Kermit coming out of high school and that he was a 2-time academic All-American in college and things like that. So they both found each other's stories interesting. And Rudy said that he felt that he was thrilled with the outcome of the book. You know, he talked about his alcoholism for the first time ever, the fact that he'd gone to rehab, mm-hmm. that AA has become such an important part of his life. He felt this was the way to talk about it publicly. This was a way to deal with it and a way to send out his message about dealing with alcoholism. So I think he felt very good. He said he felt very good about all of that. And interestingly, since the book, the two have talked. And Kermit actually coached a player in China last year who he brought back to this country, an American who was playing in China. And Rudy gave the kid a tryout in the Rockets training camp this year, essentially as a favor to Kermit. So in that sense, I feel great about the outcome of the book.
It seems to me that a guy who emerges from the book as wise and admirable is John Lucas. He's a kind of a minor character. He's a he's on the floor when the fight occurs, a teammate of Washington's back in 77. He says at the end of the punch, quote, "You know, I wish he could just say, I'm sorry, I screwed up. Sometimes in life you make a mistake and there's no buts, no explanations." I wonder if you feel that way about Kermit Washington, too, at this point.
I do, Bill. And it's funny because when Rudy read that quote, because John also went through substance abuse problems.
Right.
And he said to me, that's step nine in the 12 steps, you know, taking full responsibility. And so John knows from whence he speaks in terms of taking responsibility for your actions. And I've always felt, you know, having talked to Kermit about this now on countless occasions, he always brings up Kevin Kunert. That in his mind, it was Kevin Kunert who started the fight. That's in dispute, as you know. Their stories are different.
But right.
In Kermit's mind, Kunert started the fight. Therefore, Kunert is at least as culpable as Kermit is. And that's just not true, Bill. It was Kermit who threw the punch. He didn't mean to hurt Rudy the way he did. He was horrified. But I liken it a little bit to the guy who has one drink too many. And then he gets in his car and he's in an accident and he's horrified at what he's done. But he turns around and he says, you know, that bartender never should have served me the last drink. And in this sense, Kevin Kunert is the bartender. And I agree with John. John put it far more articulately than I could when he said that he felt that the only way for Kermit to really have peace with this is to say, I screwed up and leave out the but.
John Feinstein is the author of The Punch, published by Little Brown. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thanks for having me.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Tad Curry. We had help this week from Walter Dixon and Sean Cole, as well as from Manoli Wetherill at NPR's New York Bureau. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again, sign up for our newsletter or virtually transport yourself to a magic tournament. Please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from John Finkel, who, during his glory days, earned $250,000 playing Magic the Gathering.
Now I'm just kind of hanging on, like Michael Jordan past his prime. It's kind of sad.
Very good, John. And you can expect to hear from Michael's attorneys early Monday morning. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, educating discerning patients and dentists since 1985 about their options for the replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR, Weekend Edition.